Section 8 of The Testament of Beauty by Robert Bridges. This Legimus recording may be freely used and adapted as long as Legimus and the reader are credited. Book 3, Breed, Part 1. Having told of selfhood, ere now I tell of breed, the younger of the two arch instincts of man's nature. 'Twere well here to remember how these pictured steeds are ideas construed by the abstract intellect. Whatever abode philosophy thinketh to build, to erect a lofty temple that may shrine her faith, crowning the unvisited holiness of the hills, or thrust her fair facade amid the noisy dens of swarming industry, to invite the sons of toil, all altitude, expense, or grandeur of building subsisteth on foundations buried out of sight, which yet the good architect carrieth ever in mind, and keepeth the draught by him stored in his folios. So herein 'twas laid down what footing reason planned, divining purpose in nature, it abstracted first her main intentions, and subsumeth under each the old animal passions ancillary thereto, though in nature's economy the same impulse may work to divers ends, as demonstrably is seen in the appetite of hunger, which prime in selfhood promoteth no less all living activities. So universal, some thinkers would make it a cornerstone, and mixing other like fabric, build thereon confidently, albeit for such deep trust unfit, being in itself a thing of no substance. And truly, pleasure in food, common to all animals that can feel pleasure, comforting the incessant toil of sustenance to enable their blind energies, when once it findeth conscience in the reason of man, is posited by folly as an end in itself, till by sensuous refinement it usurpeth rank beside its intellectual and spiritual joys, a road whereon the brutes already had broken ground, trespassing somewhat haply on nature's allotments. For a tiger, when once he hath tasted human flesh, in pursuit of his prey is more dangerous to men, and chooseth daintily among them, like those cannibals who yet, for all their courtesy, so travellers tell, and Spartan stoicism, gaily devour their kind. From the terrifying jungle of his haunted childhood, where prehistoric horror still lurketh untamed, man by slow steps withdrew, and from supply of need fell to pursuit of pleasure, until his luxury, supplanting brutality, invented a new shame. For with civilization a caste of cooks was bred, not specialized in structure, as with bees or ants, but serviceable of either sex, and disciplined in such cultured tradition that the grammar of it would stock a library. Nor are their banquets spread to please the palate only. The eye is invited by dainty disguises, and the nostril with scents. Nay, even the ear is fed, and on the gathered guests a trifling music playeth, dispelling all thought, that while they fill the belly, the empty mind may float lightly in the full moonshine of o'erblown affluence. Thus, when in London city a guild of merchants dine, one dinner's cost would ease a whole by-street of want. Its broken meats outfaced Christ's thrifty miracle. But though of its mere sensual smirch the scene be cleansed at fashionable tables, where delicate guests sit and play with their food inattentively, as 'twere in their relaxation an accidental relish to the intellectual banter and familiar discourse of social entertainment, a thing overlooked among the agreeable superfluities of life, trifles good in themselves, and no more censurable than the fine linen of Ulysses and the brooch that Penelope gave him, nor the wrangled shroud that she wove for his sire, nor any work of price that humbly doeth honour unto any temple of God, yet this amenity of mammon is to the epicure mere disgust, a farrago of incongruous kickshaws, a hazardous pampering, as barbarously remote from pleasure's goal as pothouse cheese and ale. For reason, once engaged on the aesthetic of food, refineth every means, as those painters in oil who all their sunless days sat labouring to attain a chiaroscuro of full colour. So the epicure. Nor planneth he his creation with a less regard to grandiose composition in a scheme of morsels graduated to provoke and stimulate alike digestion and appetite. And each viand married with a congenial wine, and each wine in itself a sublimation of fancy, a radiant riotous juice, and of such priceless rarity as no man can come but by luck and genius to possess such bottles. And here the voluptuary may think his anchor hath bitten on truth, for surely nothing in nature fulfilleth more various expectancies of sense than his wine doth. To the eye, luminous as rich gems, engendering through long eons in the bowels of earth. To the nostrils, reminiscent as subtle odours of timorous wind-wavering flowers. To the taste, beyond all savours ravishing, insatiable, yet wholesome as is the incense of forested pines, when neath their scorching screens they fume the slumberous air. And to the mind, exhilarating, expelling care, even as those well-toned viols, matured by time, which once, when the muse visited Italy to prepare a voice of beauty for the joy of her children, were fashioned by Amati and Stradivari, and still, treasured in their mellow shapelinesses, fulfil the genius of her omnipotent destiny, speaking with incantation of a strange magic to charm the dreams that, yet undreamed, lurk in the unfathomed deep of mind, unfeatured hopes and loves and dim desires, uttermost forms of all things that shall be. 'Tis thus, by the live firework of his wine allured, that the epicure thinketh he hath wherewithal to pave, through pallet and gullet, a right path for his soul, each feast as a symphonic poem, preluding to melodious andante scherzo and final fugue, a microcosm, as those musical paeans are that perish not in the using, but persist strengthening their immortality, while millions feed on their unquenchable loveliness evermore. In such fine artistry of his putrefying pleasures, he indulgeth richly his time, until the sad day comes when he retireth with stomach emeritus to ruminate the best devoured moments of life. Like any old fox-hunter, his good days with the hounds, any angler or cricketer, for he too hath followed his sport to himself, and each good day of sport, and that the dog knoweth and enjoyeth with his master as well, is a thing in itself, whole, even as life is one. This is the supreme ecstasy of the mountaineer, to whom the morn is bright, when, with his goal in sight, some ice-peak high o'er the heavens, he is soul-bounden for it, prospecting the uncertain clue of his perilous step, to scale precipices where no foot clomb afore, for good or ill success, to his last limit of strength. His joy in the doing, and his life in his hand, he glorieth in the fortunes of his venturous day, mid the high mountain silences, where poesy lieth in dream, and with the secret strength of things that governs thought, inhabiteth, where man wandereth into God's presence. But what heavenly or earthly muse attendeth the epicure? Nay, what man deigneth ear to his grovelling tale? His gluttony rotteth and stinketh in the dustbin of ethic. Howso that may be, the thing cometh of self, as war doth, and hereby 'twere well to note how some would derive war from breed, though sex is but the occasion, when jealousy of love provoketh selfhood to anger. Indeed, Herodotus, seeking the root cause of the implacable enmity twixt Hellenes and Asiatics to convey his book, dresseth up a frontispiece of four royal rapes, of Io and Medea, Europa and Helen of Troy, playing, no doubt, upon the flair of his hearers, who love him still for his good faith in his fables. Yet our distinction is proper, and holdeth fast. Now breed is to the race, as selfhood is to the individual, and these two prime instincts, as they differ in purpose, are independent each from other, and separate as are the organic tracts in the animal body whereby they function. and though breed is needful alike to plants as to animals, yet its apparatus is found in animals of a more special kind. And since race propagation might have been assured without differentiation of sex, we are left to guess nature's intention from its full effects in man, and such matter is the first that will follow hereon. Remembering my dissension from Spinoza here, I think of him, Bruno's pupil. Upsipolis, Apollis, in his pride at his bench intently shaping his lenses, and how he, in that irksome toil to earn his bread, the while he pondered his great book, was perfecting the tool that invited science to ever minuter anatomy, until she took skill to handle invisibles, and lately upon that path hath divined, in the observed fertilization of plants, atomic mechanism with unlimited power to vary the offspring in character, by mutual inexhaustible interchange of transmitted genes, a theory on such wide experiment upbuilt that the enrichment of species may assume to be the purpose of nature in the segregation of sex. Yet this new knowledge throweth no light on our way to a purposeful and wise self-breeding of mankind, which, could it be, would then responsibly overrule all indiscriminate mating, though from such ordeal our hybrid wisdom well might shrink. Rather, we see complexity irresolvable in obscurity. So may we still follow our instinctive preferences unrebuked, and in love of beauty affirm our faith that our happiest espousals are nature's free gift. And the origin of sex lieth yet in that darkness where all origins are, since definition of links within our causal chain advanceth us no way in sensible approachment to the first cause of all. We are happy in our discoveries, as a child thinketh he is nearer to the pole star when he is put to bed. Yet, tracing backwards in the story of sex, the steps of our carpeted staircase are familiar and strong. First, among lowest types of life, we think to find no separation of sex. Plants, in the next degree, show differentiation at puberty with some signs of mutual approachment. Next, in higher animals, an early differentiation, and at puberty, periodic appetite with mutual attraction, sometimes engaging beauty. Then, at last, in man, all these same characters promoted and strengthened to a constant, conscient passion, by reason transformed toward altruistic emotion and spiritual love. Breed, then, together with selfhood, steppeth in pair, for a self grew through reason from animal rage to vice of war and gluttony, but meanwhile uprose through motherly yearning to a profounder affection, so breed, from like degrading brutality at heart, distilleth in the altruism of spiritual love to be the sublimest passion of humanity with parallel corruption. In its supremacy, confessed of all, since all in their degree have felt its divine exaltation and bestial abasement. It hath sanctified fools and degraded heroes, and though the warrior will lightly leave his lady to join in battle, so the weight of the elder horse side wrencheth at the yoke, he will return to her more gladly, and often rue his infidelity. End of section 8.